This is the last episode of Season 7. As always, we will take a short break for you to catch up with episodes you may have missed. Please do write to us via Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn if you have any suggestions for people to interview. The more stories we can share around the world, the more powerful the learning is. Look for @SmithaTharoor and connect with me on any one of those platforms. See you again in a couple of months. This interview is for those living in the country of your birth, but experiencing discrimination from your own countrymen and women on entirely superficial grounds of facial feature differences. For the others who are listening and appreciate that they fit in like the majority, how do you react when you meet your own fellow country person who doesn't look anything like you? This is Between Us, Stories of Unconscious Bias. I am Smitha Tharoor. I'd like to introduce Oktoli Tuku. Oktoli is a learning and development expert with over a decade of experience. Originally from Nagaland and the foothills of the Himalayan mountains in the northeast corner of India, Oktoli has since lived in 5 countries. These are Qatar, USA, Thailand, China, and India. Oktoli has trained over 1,000 professionals globally on various leadership development topics. Nagaland sounds like such a beautiful place, and it's been on my wish list forever. So I've already said to Oktoli, I'm going to plan a trip, and she's going to have to tell me all about it. But I'm connected to this beautiful place called Nagaland. I know that Oktoli is going to have lots of stories to share around unconscious bias. So thank you so very much for joining me today, Oktoli.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so honored.
No, that's so kind. So, you know, unconscious bias, you and I have talked about. You are a learning and development consultant, and you probably worked within this arena already. What do you understand by unconscious bias?
It's interesting you would ask me that because I learned it from you. I was in my mid-20s. I remember when I first met you, I was going into training rooms that were mostly filled with men, twice my age, you know, leading multinational companies, educated from top B schools. And I was so sure that they would just take one look at me and dismiss anything that I have to say. Because I grew up being conditioned to believe that I had to be a man or of a certain age to be taken seriously, right? So when we met and I told you that I was being subjected to a lot of discrimination, you asked me specifically about scenarios where I felt marginalized. And one of the things that I pointed out is that people would constantly ask me where I'm from or like what my education background was. And for me, that was them asking me these questions to almost belittle me, obviously, right? Until that day that I met you and you asked me, what if they just want to know where you're from and what your background is just out of curiosity? And I had never thought of it like that. And it was such a liberating experience for me because I had created this bondage for myself and I was living in it, believing that I will never be taken seriously because I'm not a man and I'm not of a certain age, right? So all these stereotypes that I have of people buried deeply in my mind, they do impact the way that I treat people and the way I think. And as unintentional as they are, I definitely don't believe that they are harmless. And so this, for me, is unconscious bias.
Oh, that's such a wonderful reply. And thank you for sharing that story from all those years ago. Oktoli, I really appreciate that. That conversation that you and I had, you know, and I remember it vividly in my own head, you know, mattered and made you kind of, I think the word you use right now is bondage, and it just goes to show, doesn't it, to what degree we create our own bondage. We create our own self-limitation, self-limiting beliefs and ideas of who we are and what we can do. Yeah, that's a very powerful story, so thank you. But then, I mean, that's one example where you appreciated what these two words mean and how you were creating your own bondage. But could you perhaps share some other stories with us, Oktoli?
Sure. There is one that I'm currently struggling with. And I also think that there are a lot of women who also struggle with a similar unconscious bias. So I wanted to share that. So my husband and I, we both have full-time jobs and neither of us have the time to cook like two hot meals every day, like, you know, how we normally would in India. So we sat down and we decided, you know, we'll cook whenever we have the time. And if we don't, we'll just order in or just make do with leftovers. And while he doesn't feel guilty for not cooking, I do. Like almost every day that I don't cook. And he's told me so many times it's okay because he understands, you know, we both have jobs. But this guilt that I'm not a good wife, it just won't go away. And recently I was spending some time just, you know, looking back and evaluating why is it that I feel this way. I realized that there is a very deeply seated belief in my mind that somehow good wives cook meals for their husbands. And this came from my own upbringing, right? My mother's mother, grandmother, died when my mother was in fourth grade. So my grandfather never remarried. He raised his three daughters to be independent, educated them. And, you know, for taking care of, you know, the kitchen chores, he just hired a help. So my mother didn't grow up learning how to cook, but she had an amazing job until recently she retired. And she financially took care of all of us children. My father, on the other hand, lost his father when he was a teenager. So his mother was uneducated. She never remarried, but she was taking up the role of being a father and a mother. So she worked really hard. And the best way she knew how was to nurture them, care for them, cook for them, and do all of those things at home, right? So you can imagine when my parents met and they got married, the story that unfolded, because they both had very distorted ideas of what, you know, a husband's role is or a wife's role is. And so eventually when they got separated, everyone blamed my mother and said that it was because she didn't know how to serve her husband, which primarily was cooking and cleaning up after him. So as an educated woman married to a wonderful man who does not think it's a woman's job to cook and feed my husband, I know in my head that it's okay if I don't cook. But I often catch myself feeling so guilty if I go without cooking for a week. So like 2 or 3 days is okay. But if it's already a week, then I feel really, really guilty. And it's just this unconscious bias that I know I'm not the only person who feels this way. I just wanted to share this story.
It's a great story because, I mean, what you've said, you know, just kind of to summarize what you're saying for all of us, for the listeners and for myself, there are a couple of things here. Firstly, it's about us, you, me, whoever we are. We're listening to your story, of course. And our narrative and our upbringing and who we are and how are we brought up and what kind of value systems are embedded within us. Mm-hmm. And unusually for your mother's generation growing up in India, in Nagaland, I'm assuming, she was brought up with a value system that was extremely feminist, forward thinking, and not typical of a patriarchal home. Whereas your father, because of his circumstances, was diametrically opposite. Now, it's not whether one is good or one is bad. It's not about making judgments about whether that's the right thing to do or that is the wrong thing to do. But it is about so much that because of how we are embedded with, you know, almost an DNA about what we think is the right way to live, we react to situations in a particular way. And that's what you're saying, aren't you, Oktoli? Because this idea of guilt, as you correctly said, you're not alone in this. And it's not about India. The idea of patriarchy and patriarchal households is all over the world. And certainly during COVID, there's enough research and analysis done where they have seen that both husband and wife working remotely from home because they can't go anywhere because it's COVID. And yet, this is where I don't get the exact figures, but women do far higher percentage of housework than men. The wife, they both got full-time jobs. They could even have two little children running around. And it's COVID, and so the kids can't go to school. I mean, it's hard. And yet the women will do more. So that comes out of society, don't you think? Society's yes. expectations?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm married to someone from the south of India. So my husband also grew up in a very similar, you know, situation where as a man, he didn't know how to cook. Like his mother never allowed him to be in the kitchen because his mother said, your place is not in the kitchen. So until we got married, he didn't know how to cook. That said, because he is such a wonderful person, he has learned how to cook. And every now and then, I know that even in his unconscious bias, he'll say, you know, I've never cooked before in my life and I do this only for you. And I tell him,
I have to laugh. Yes, that's a classic example of, you know, I remember hearing, I think it might have been Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, the feminist and novelist, the Nigerian American novelist. And I think it might have been her story. And she talks about, certainly in the West, as you know, most families now have dishwashers. And the example that she gives is how when the husband either loads or unloads the dishwasher, he turns to the wife and says, I've done this for you. Or the wife says to the husband, thank you so much for unloading the dishwasher for me. And what does that say in terms of our unconscious bias? What it says, and it's not just the husband's responsibility, it is both people in a heterosexual relationship. It is about saying that me, the woman, the wife, has already taken ownership of what needs to be done in the house unconsciously. It's my job, my ownership. So thank you so much for cooking for me, for unloading my dishwasher. It's just a word, but you see what I'm saying here? Mm-hmm. And that then suggests unconsciously to the partner that you're the person in charge.
Absolutely.
It's such a common story. And I'm thankful that you've shared it because people are going to be nodding their heads and say, yes, Octoli, we've been there. That's great. Yeah. I mean, it's something that obviously you need to challenge within yourself and as much as your husband does, that it's shared love of good health and good food. It's not a burden.
And he needs to, like, he also consciously needs to keep telling himself that doing these things, I mean, of course, I would acknowledge it, but it's not something that needs to be celebrated that, oh, wow, like you cooked a meal, because it's something that, I mean, if you want to eat, you have to cook or like you have to order in, right? So it's this just this is it. So he needs to keep toning down his appreciate me because no one does this and I'm doing it for you. And then I need to stop feeling guilty about not cooking. So yeah,
exactly.
We both need to work at it.
You both need to work at it. But it's also about even simple things like me and I, because it just words, the language that we use suggests subliminally, unconsciously, that one person has more ownership over a particular task than the other. So that's also worth remembering and thinking about.
Wow. I've never looked at it that way. That's a good one.
Yeah, I remember hearing that somewhere. But do continue, Octoli. I'm sharing another story. I'm loving it.
So there's another one that I have, which in retrospect, when I was thinking about it today, I was almost like just slapped my forehead and went, oh my gosh, like, what were you thinking? But, you know, I grew up watching a lot of Hollywood productions, right? Hollywood movies. And normally, or I mean, usually there are a lot of movies that imply that Americans are very culturally ignorant and arrogant, right? So this is just something that you see on television over and over again, that it's okay, you know, that Americans will make fun of like other races and whether it's sarcasm or just different types of humor. Anyway, before I landed in the US to study, I told myself that this is what you're going to get. So you need to be okay with it, right? And so when I got the usual, oh, isn't cricket an insect? Or did you go to school on a camel? Or why do all Indians smell of curry? I just laughed it off and I didn't pay much attention to it because I was expecting them, right? Confirmation bias, right? Mm-hmm. So how this ended poorly for me was one day a student came up to me and said, I'm so sorry for the way Mrs. Norma has been discriminating you. And I just want you to know that if you ever want to report it, I would back you up. And I was shocked because I realized I had become so immune and so used to these derogatory comments that I had no idea the teacher was treating me differently anymore. Sure, it was a great defense mechanism, but in doing so, I was unconsciously almost enabling them to continue discriminating people, you know, of different races. And that, for me, I think that was another like life-changing experience where I felt, oh no, like, I should not be contributing to it or enabling that kind of behavior.
Actually, that's a very important point that you've made, Octoli, and thank you for that. Because it isn't just about us. Firstly, of course, what you're saying is that, you know, when somebody is discriminating against you, against me, against whoever it might be, we don't want to feel that sense of insecurity or discomfort. And so we just create our own reality. That's what you're saying. And we just pretend that, you know, it's like in the movies, forget about it. It's going to go away. And we try not to take it personally, because what you don't want is to allow that to rule your life. So you want to feel safe, you want to feel secure. You, me, anyone, you know what I mean? And that's sort of the reasons why many of us may not react back to it. But then the second point that you made, which is crucial, is that by your not reacting for your own sake, what you're then doing is encouraging and enabling, that's the word you used, enabling those people to continue their discriminatory comments and derogatory comments to many other people, including you. That's what you're saying. Is that correct?
Yes, yes, absolutely. There are so many people, I mean, that would come after me, and people, if I didn't speak up, then people would just assume that it's okay to, you know, tell them, do you not take a shower because you're brown all the time? Like, you know, these are comments that I've heard, and I just thought it was funny, and I just laughed it off because...
And this is now, Octolia? I mean, when were you in the US? How many years ago?
Oh, 2012, 13. Yeah.
So we're talking 10 years ago.
10 years ago.
10 years ago, I am taken aback. And where in the US were you?
This is in Hawaii.
Right. So just 10 years ago, you are in Hawaii in the United States of America, and you are facing discrimination because of who you are in terms of what you look like, your physical appearance.
Right.
And did you feel, because as we know, people from Northeast India also have a physical appearance, could be even possibly Chinese because of the borderlines are so close. Mm-hmm. Do you feel it was because you didn't look what I would say typical, whatever that means, you know, more darker brown skin, different features? Is that the reason you were discriminated against? Or is it because you looked Indian? I'm sorry to ask, and forgive me, it's a very personal question, but I'm really trying to understand where this came from and what it is that they saw in you to discriminate against you.
Not at all. I don't mind the questions at all. To be honest, I don't think I'll ever know what made them look at me differently because I can't speak for them. Mm-hmm. But what I do know is that I was known as that Indian kid, right?
Right.
So my name is difficult to pronounce. And so, you know, people would just refer to me as that Indian kid. And so they knew I was from India. And so
your name is phonetic. How can you mispronounce your first name? You just see what you say.
Right.
How you say what you see.
But then I also just realized, as you were asking me this question, when you talked about how I'm from a part of the country where we have different features, I also realized that actually much, much before I landed in the US, I had already experienced quite a bit of these derogatory and discriminatory, you know, comments even before I moved to the US. So when I moved from the northeast of India to the south here in Chennai, where I live now, people, one, would just automatically assume I'm Chinese. People would call me dumpling momos, or people would just ask me questions like, oh, Chinese people eat dogs, right? Or like, you know, just all sorts of, you know, do you eat snakes? And, you know, what kind of homes do you live in? Do you live in the jungle? And all sorts of things that I think that building up of that, you know, defense mechanism already even started like way before I landed in the US. And maybe that's why I was so immune to all of those comments.
I think that makes a lot of sense, Octoli, because if we were to be really stereotypical in terms of physical descriptions, as often people are in India, people from Chennai, which is where you live, which is in southern India, features are completely different. Color of skin is completely different. Shade of color of brown, darker usually than somebody like you. And yes, you could be wandering anywhere, not just south of southern India, anywhere in India, outside of where you grew up, which is northeast India, and people could assume that you're not Indian because of your features. And so what you're saying, which is very sad, is that India is your country of birth. India is the country you love, you've grown up in. And India is the country that has first taught you what racism means.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say in response to that. I'm just saddened and moved in equal measure.
You know, when people ask me, they usually will exhaust like all of the Asian countries. Are you from China? Are you from Japan? Are you from Korea? Are you from Thailand? Are you from Nepal? Are you from Bhutan? And I just look at them and I go, you can exhaust all the Asian countries in the world and you would still not be able to know where I'm from. Like, especially when I meet people here, even today, like people will still ask me. And so one of the things that I usually tell them is, and this is when I was going into training rooms where people would think that I am either Thai or, you know, Korean or Chinese. And I would tell them, you know, you could just ask me, where are you from? Or like, where is home for you? And I will tell you, I'm from Nagaland, which is in the northeast of India, right? You don't have to waste so much energy and time trying to guess like all of the Asian countries. And this is a tip that you can use anywhere in the world when you meet somebody, instead of guessing where they're from, because ideally what you're doing is you're stereotyping them based on how they look. Like, instead of doing that, more inclusive way would be just to ask them, where is home for you? And they would tell you where is home for them.
I like that. I like that a lot. Where is home for you? Yes. That's so interesting that you use the word home. Because, I mean, we have to remind ourselves that you have a lovely home where you live with your husband and neither of you cook. Both of you cook occasionally. But no, you know what I mean. I'm just kidding. You have a lovely home. And yet, here's a question. You know, when you said, where is home for you? Home is such a big word, isn't it, Oktoli?
Yeah, it is. Like, if you asked me where is home for me, I would actually tell you my entire story. Like, I was born in a tiny village. So we had about 80 families in the village. I grew up knowing everybody's names. Every Sunday we would gather in the church, so we would know, you know, every single family member of every, you know, household. And we would know what their interests are. We would commune together. Like, we would eat meals together. We would visit each other. And so it was such a small community. So that was like growing up, that was home for me. And then when I was 17, I moved to Chennai, right? And after I moved here and graduated, that's when I, you know, started living in different countries for work and studying some more. And so if I told you where is home for me and where home has been for me in the last few years, I mean, there would be so many stories that would actually be fun. And you might even be able to connect with me and say, oh my gosh, I love Thailand. I've also lived in Thailand. Or, oh, I went to university in the US too. Like, we could find all of those commonalities and we could actually have a really nice conversation. But if you end up trying to guess where I'm from, then I'm already slightly annoyed that you are just stereotyping me, and the chances of us having a good conversation is just out the window.
Yeah. But here's an obvious question that I'm going to have to ask, because I'm sure the listeners would want to ask you the same question, which is, you said China and Thailand were two of the countries you traveled to. Mm-hmm. We've just talked about the fact that your facial features, people make assumptions that you could be from either of those two countries, including many others.
Right.
When you lived there, did you feel any different while you were living in that country? Did you feel included, accepted? Or were you a foreigner there too? Purely from a superficial perspective.
Yeah. I was a foreigner there too. Because, I mean, you know, I don't know how to explain this, but a Korean would be able to tell the difference between a Korean and a Chinese, right? So just yes, like that, a Chinese can tell the difference between like who is Chinese and who is not. So they can tell that I'm not Chinese. And even Thai people also feel the same way. They look at me and they go, okay, you look Asian, but you're definitely not Thai, right?
So where are you from? Yes.
Yeah. Where are you from? For you?
Yeah. And I wanted you to say that, because what we tend to do, unfortunately, is we just jump to conclusions. Ah, she'd have been fine in Thailand. She looks like them. She'd have been fine in China, whereas that's not the case at all. And I just wanted you to state the obvious, because, of course, it's not that simple. But, yeah, what about the fact that your accent has not an Indian accent? Would that have made a difference, do you think, while you were in India and suffering, in my opinion, extreme, hurtful, discriminatory behavior?
Oh, this is a really good question. So I grew up in Nagaland, where we have 16 tribes and all of us speak very different languages. And everyone speaks English as an official language in Nagaland. And so everyone has an accent, right? Like an accent that's influenced by our mother tongue. And what we would do as people from different tribes is we would make fun of each other's accent, just like, you know, how Americans will make fun of Indian accents, or like Indians will make fun of an Australian accent. We also made fun of like different accents within the tribes, just for fun, right? And I always felt very conscious of the fact that if I had an accent that was, you know, close to what my tribal people speak, then other tribes would make fun of me. And so I made it a point to watch as many movies as possible, and actually ended up correcting my accent to the way I speak right now so that I would not get picked on. And so people assume, oh, you sound American because you went to university in the US. Oh, I actually spoke like this way before I went to the US. This is something that I learned along the way from watching movies.
And you did that to protect yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
Think about that, Octoli. That is the power, isn't it? Of wanting to feel safe and wanting to feel secure. And clearly you have a good ear, which some of us don't. If you ask me to do accents, I can tell you I'll fail miserably. But you have a good ear. You have that gift to be able to pick up. And so imagine watching movies. Can I ask, how old were you when you made this decision?
Oh, I was very, very young, maybe even like 6, 7, because I went to a boarding school when I was 5 and started watching movies then in school and, you know, just repeating the words that I would hear on the television whenever we would have movie nights and things like that. So even just as little as 5.
Wow. So think about that. This little 5-year-old, that says so much about you, Octoli, as a human being. The determination, the motivation of a little girl, age 5, 6, saying, I don't want to feel bad. I don't want to feel, I don't like the fact that people are discriminatory and make me feel bad because of their comments. So I'm going to create a persona for myself that reduces the discrimination. That's what you did at such a young age.
Yeah, I mean, as a country, and even just as a state, we're very diverse. As a country, we're very diverse. So there is bound to be some kind of discrimination at some level, right? And this is found just to be the safest way to get along with everybody and not get picked on.
And it's worked, hasn't it?
To some it degree. Has. You know, there are times when people will say, why do you fake an accent? And that, like, really upsets me because they don't know the story, right? I mean, I know it's just a very harmless question because maybe they're just curious, but even just if they wanted to ask that question in a way that was not offensive, they can ask me, how are you able to switch from like this accent to that accent? Because I speak many Indian languages, by the way. I speak Hindi, I speak Tamil, where I live now, I speak Tamil, and not many people can, right? And so when I speak Tamil and I'm on the phone, people will never know that I'm not from here. So when I call an Uber driver and he sees my face, he literally will drive past me. And this has happened to me 100 times. They'll drive past me because they're like, you cannot be that person speaking Tamil because you like had such authentic pronunciation. And that's just been something that's in my head.
You have a gift for language, yeah, and yeah, accents.
Right. So it would be so offensive when people tell me, why do you fake an accent? Because, well, I switch accents so that you can understand me better, right? As an American, it's difficult for them to understand Indian accent because it's difficult. As an Indian, it's difficult when Americans, you know, have an accent because it's just different. It's not something that you're used to. So I am actually doing you a favor by adjusting or switching my accent so it's easier for you to understand. But instead, people see it as, oh, you're just being fake. And so that's something that really upsets me. But over time, I think it's in the last few years, what I've done is I've decided that I would speak, I don't know, just not really caring too much about like, do I sound American? Do I sound British? Do I sound Indian? But just have my own accent. And so now it's just completely mixed up. Like I'll have very strong like consonant sounds, like, you know, how a normal Indian would. And then I would also roll my R's, you know, and so it's a very confused accent.
You. But it's yours.
But it's
you
me.
Own it.
Yeah, I own it. And I'm very comfortable with it. And so I usually use this now as a joke and be like, okay, if you're confused where I'm from because of like my confusing accent, I'll tell you. And then like, I'll tell them my story. And that becomes like a way for them to get to know me a little bit more. And that's usually how.
I love that, Octoli, because, you know, you've been so candid, so honest. And I really appreciate that. Because in terms of accents, we all change how we speak instinctively, unconsciously, to fit in. It's as much about helping the other person understand you better, but it's also about my not wanting to be different. Everyone likes to feel part of the group, feel included. It's an instinctive, unconscious feeling that all of us have. We don't want to be standing out like a sore thumb with an accent that doesn't fit with everybody else. So we just switch. And depending on where you are, if you go back home to Nagaland, I bet your accent will change again. And that's just how it is. We want to feel embedded within the culture we're at. And so we unconsciously just speak differently. And of course, you have the added benefit of having an extremely good ear and being very, very good at just instinctively switching and changing accents. So yeah, that's wonderful. So Octoly, you know, you have all these stories and the idea of the life lessons that you have taught yourself is extremely powerful for all of us to take away. But do you have some sort of mantra? Do you manage any unconscious biases on a daily level? What do you do?
I think one big life lesson that I implement in my life that has really helped me is to show grace. I mean, for two reasons, right? We all have unconscious bias. And if we all do, like, who even gives us the right to judge each other? And second thing is actually something that my mother always says, that nobody ever changes their way from being condemned or shamed. And so if we're wanting to see people change, shaming them and condemning them is not the way to go about it. And I think that when people, you know, extend grace to each other, that's when people are motivated to change, because I think love and grace is a much bigger motivation than, you know, shaming. So that for me, I think grace is a big one for me. Another one is something that I do on a regular basis. Like even today, as I was thinking about the stories, I kept asking myself, why? And I think, like, you know, just to keep asking yourself why is such a big one for me. Like, why do I feel comfortable this way? Why do I think this way? Or why did I think that he meant to offend me? And you just keep asking why, because trying to understand my motive behind why I do or say what I do or say helps me evaluate, like, what's driving my behavior, right? And if I realize that it's not coming from a good place, then the chances of me changing, you know, to have a better, newer perspective is higher than if I'm never aware of, like, where that's coming from. So I think just keep asking yourself why and show grace to people. I think those would be the two things that would be a big takeaway for me.
That's beautiful. And I love the word grace. It just conjures up all kinds of emotions. This is lovely. Thank you, Octoly Tikku. Thank you so much for your honesty, for your generosity, and for your grace in sharing these wonderful stories of unconscious bias with me today.
Oh, thank you. I want to thank you, actually, because you started me on this journey. And really, I'm not just saying this to be nice. I really mean it when I say that I don't think I would have the kind of confidence and just the kind of acceptance that I have for myself the way I do today had not met you then. And so I just want to thank you for helping me get out of my own head and start owning my narrative. And yeah, just be confident and proud of who I am today.
Oh, thank you. That's very moving. Thank you so much, Octoly. To announce that my podcast series is now heard in 104 countries, ranging from Guadeloupe to Iceland, Argentina to Palestine, and even Morocco. It is ranked in the top 3% worldwide. This is clearly a series that connects with people all over the world, and you are one of them. I thank you for listening. I would also like to thank Jack Godfrey for his original music in the closing of each podcast interview. If you like this episode, please do share, rate, and review. I am Smita Tharoor. Until next time.